Welcome to Basic Brewing Radio for Thursday, March 18th, 2010. I'm James Spencer. Here at Basic Brewing Radio, we're all about home brewing. With this week, author Stan Hieronymus joins us to talk about his book, Brewing with Wheat, The Wit and Weizen of World Wheat Beer Styles. We'll get some background on some of the current and past wheat beer styles and get some tips on how to brew them ourselves. If you're new to home brewing and would like to get into the hobby for the first time, check out our website, basicbrewing.com, where you can find archives of our audio and video podcasts and our DVDs to walk you through basic and more advanced brewing techniques. And you can follow me on Twitter. I'm Basic Brewing, all one word. You can find me on Facebook at facebook.com/basicbrewing.james. And you can find our show on Facebook at facebook.com/basicbrewing. And thanks to everybody, again, clicking on the Amazon.com associate link on our basicbrewing.com site. Whenever you think of Amazon, think of us and click on our associate link first. It won't cost you any extra, and you'll be helping us to bring you this show. And we appreciate your support greatly. You can also find associate links for Brew Your Own Magazine and the American Homebrewers Association on our site, too. Stan and I talked for a good long time, but I do want to take a moment to read a bit of feedback after last week's show featuring Sean Terrell's starter experiment. I got a bunch of positive comments and a couple, like this one, that challenge Sean's results. This is from Brian in Seattle, Washington. Brian says, while Sean Terrell mostly followed sound scientific practice in his experiment, he drew a negative conclusion towards stir plates without ever validating any data at all on them. He readily referenced the Mr. Malty pitching rate calculator, and on Sean's own page, he admits to statistically identical results to the Mr. Malty shaken agitation predictions when Sean ran his experiment using DME. Sean then, however, somehow rationalizes that the predicted results for a stir plate that he simulated may be overstated. Brian says, if you look at the drop-down menus in the Mr. Malty calculator, they clearly show that the predicted growth results of continuous aeration are expected to exceed intermittent shaking. What Sean refers to as simulated stir plate is effectively intermittent shaking. The Mr. Malty calculator then goes on to show that the predicted growth results on a continuous agitated stir plate will exceed continuous aeration, making it the best option. In fact, the predicted growth rate differential from continuous aeration to continuous agitation on a stir plate exceeds the differential from intermittent shaking to continuous aeration. Brian says, I don't see how Sean could have reached the conclusion that the stir plate method was overrated based on his experiment data when he did not include a stir plate in the experiment options. I would like to challenge Sean to conduct a further experiment where he includes a stir plate. Well, thanks, Brian. I'd like to see a follow-up, too, using a stir plate to see if Sean's assumptions are valid. He did shake it quite a bit, although it wasn't continuous as if he had a stir plate. But that's part of the scientific process, you know, doing experiments, gathering data, publishing the results, getting feedback from other scientists, in this case other brewers, and doing follow-up experiments to validate or to rebut the findings. So whether it's Sean or Brian or somebody else who wants to step up to the plate, the stir plate, if you will, if you'd want to do the data or do the experiment yourself with a stir plate and the other methods that Sean compared, send me your data and we'll see how it compares. Now let's get into our chat with Stan Hieronymus, author of Brewing with Wheat. Well, Stan Hieronymus, welcome to Basic Brewing Radio.
It's a pleasure to be back.
It's been a while since we've talked.
Like 4 years, I think.
Yeah, and last time I talked to you, you and your book, Brew Like a Monk, pretty much invited me into the world of brewing Belgian-ish beers, so thank you for that.
I'm glad you're enjoying it.
Now, this time you're talking about wheat. The first question, I guess, is why wheat?
Well, the real reason I did the book is because Ree Daniels asked me to. And I think he was thinking about it for several years. When we did the Belgian series, which you'll recall was first Farmhouse Ales by Phil Markowski, originally was going to write everything Belgian, but realized that'd be too gigantic. And then Wild Brews by Jeff Sparrow. And then my book, which is called Brew Like a Monk, about the Trappist and Abbey Ales. And we were sitting in a meeting after everything's mapped out and Farmhouse is already written, Wild Brews is pretty well written and being edited. And I said, have you noticed what's missing? And that was Whitbeers. And Randy Mosher said, can't you just throw that in with the Trappist beers? Because, as a matter of fact, Königshaven was beginning to do a Whitbeer. And I said, it has nothing to do with tradition. And I think right then it logged in Ray's brain, and like 2 or 3 years later he sprung it on me when he thought, well, let's have the wheat beers, and doggone Stan should do the wit.
Well, wheat is not only a style or several styles, but wheat is also a kind of, you know, hidden ingredient in beers that you may not know it's there, right?
Oh, yeah. For instance, anytime you drink a Boulevard beer, if you have, say, their single wide, which is their IPA, that has a small portion of wheat in it. Many brewers will use a little bit of wheat just for the foam stability.
And what does wheat bring to a beer besides foam stability?
One thing that I learned early on is that as I went to Anheuser-Busch to their pilot plant, which is now known as the Michelob Brewery, it's right in the complex in St. Louis, and it's 9 stories tall, and it mimics their large brewery. And at the time, this was about a year ago, they had their 4-pack out with 4 different wheat beers, and I asked them what wheat brings to a beer, and what they said, one of the most important things is what it doesn't bring is it's not barley malt. Hmm. It doesn't have those flavors, and some people don't like the barley malt flavors, so it can slightly lighten the flavor of a beer. Most of what you get when you taste a wheat beer, whether it's a wit beer or Hefeweiss, or of course, like the Berliner Weiss, or now a Goza, is yeast character and how it interacts with the wheat and the flavors, the interaction with the wheat, and you certainly see that, which is classic in the Hefeweiss, is there are precursors within the wheat that react with the yeast to give you that clove character.
And we can talk in a few minutes about how to tweak your beer,
right,
to get those out. But most people new to brewing would think a wheat beer is made out of all wheat. But that can't happen, right?
Well, you can do an all-wheat beer. And I've tasted an all-wheat IPA, as a matter of fact.
Really?
And it didn't taste the wheat at all. You know, it was mashed at a higher temperature, so those precursors were not released, and it was fermented with California ale yeast, and then it had lots of hops, and you really got the hops and a neutral yeast character. But 100% wheat is really hard to work with because the wheat is much more glutinous, and therefore it's hard to mash, and that's a thing that really scares off beginning brewers, I think. Is because you get that stuck mash and say, I don't want to go do that again.
Now, is there a magical ratio of barley to wheat?
Well, traditionally, within the Hefeweiss, it's going to be generally about, first of all, by law in Germany, it has to be more than half. Generally, it's going to be about 60%. Some people go to more like 70% wheat.
Now, you brought up the law. Over time, wheat has run into the law a few times.
Yeah, well, you think about it, and it's actually the first time reading this in the early days of reading Michael Jackson, and as he pointed out, that there was somewhat of a natural selection process. Barley works better for malting and putting into beer than wheat does because of those problems of working with wheat, that it's harder to mash. You've got those additional proteins. Those proteins immediately, other than the fact that people don't like the look of cloudy beer, it's shortening the lifespan of that beer. You've got much more chance of infections, for instance, when you get those higher proteins, mm-hmm. and other issues of dealing with proteins. So wheat didn't work as well. But at the very beginning, when people weren't clear what they were doing, wheat was as likely to be used as barley. A lot of spelt was used, for instance. So people were just using grains. Then over time, barley became more popular. Additionally, though, farmers were not nearly as productive 800, 900 years ago. So you had times where you had shortages of grain. When that happened, sometimes the government said, wheat cannot be used for anything other than making bread.
So was that the justification behind the Reinheitsgebot?
Well, we could get in all kinds of political issues if you want to talk Reinheitsgebot, because some of it is just a matter of the government being able to tax more effectively. But the Reinheitsgebot came about first, and that was sort of a German purity law, but there were also the tax issues. And wheat continued, was allowed to be brewed in some small parts under license. And then about 1600, royalty realized, hey, people really like this wheat beer, and they took over the license. Mm-hmm. They were the only brewer, and they were the only ones allowed to brew with wheat until it fell out of favor a couple hundred years later, and they lost interest, and then they started allowing first monasteries to brew it, and then a few larger estates. And by the middle of the 19th century, there was almost no brewing of what we consider hefeweizen, until George Schneider was allowed to brew it, and he was a commoner. And when that happened, other commoners were also allowed to brew the Hefeweizen style, and the revival began about then. But it took about 100 years before it became popular. It wasn't really till the 1970s.
Now, this kind of happened in over time in more than once, where you had wheat beers being popular, then they kind of died off, and one or two breweries picked them up again, and then they resurged in popularity. Now, the character of those beers changed over time, though, right? Because the brewing methods changed and the technology changed. And so what we're drinking today as, you know, traditional wheat beer styles, quote-unquote, may not be what they were way back in the day.
Well, I think the Hefeweizen is probably the closest, but the very popular beers, if people who came to home brewing in the resurgence of the 1980s and the 1990s became acquainted with German Hefeweizen pretty early on. It was becoming popular there. So you would look back and say in the United States in the 19th century, there were all these Weiss beers, and think that's what they're like, because that's the beer you got. You very seldom got Berliner Weiss. Well, Americans were brewing Berliner Weiss. You know, that was the prominent style in Germany in the 19th century. So that's what German brewers brought over, was going to be something like the Berliner Weiss. It wasn't nearly as popular as you might think. There are all these bottles floating around if you're a memorabilia collector, but that's because the Berliner Weiss was mostly a bottle product. No brewery made very much money making Berliner Weiss. But that's an example where we start to mix the styles in our head. Berliner Weiss is, you know, certainly by the 18th century was a sour, tart beer. much like it is now. You know, it's the sourness and tartness has gone up and down. The way it's been produced has gone up and down. Its popularity has gone up and down. But it was pretty similar to the way it is now, although there's only one producer left in Berlin.
Now, that you said that pre-Prohibition, Berliner Weiss was the wheat beer that the brewers who brewed with wheat in America brewed,
yes.
Which that really surprised me.
It surprised me, too. When I started, I hadn't really thought about that. And I had a conversation with Eric Warner, who, of course, wrote the first wheat beer book for Brewers Publications, which is a fabulous book. And a little light went off. He's going, well, of course, where would they have gotten the yeast? You know, when they came over here in 1850, it wasn't being made in the south of Germany. It would have been almost impossible to get the same yeast that's being used now.
So what is a Berliner Weiss? I mean, how would you describe it?
Well, it's a low, a Berliner Weiss is, it's a style I would love to see become more prominent. And it is a little bit, you know, for instance, the brewery in California, which hasn't been around 2 years and it's getting a lot of attention, and first for their Orchard White and their other beers, that they make a Berliner Weiss. But Notting Head in Philadelphia, which is a brew pub and doesn't bottle their beer, likes to claim they are the second largest Berliner Weiss producer in the world, and they brew seven barrel batches a year. So that's not very much. Closer would be now Dogfish Head makes the flavored, what they call neo or pseudo Berliner Weiss, which it is, but it does have a sour element. But it's a beer with around 3% alcohol with a lot of lactic character. You know, in the old days, they were probably sour. And as a matter of fact, therefore, they're dosed with Woodruff or other syrups in order to cut that sourness.
And you were saying that if you actually go to Germany, where the Berliner Weiss is served, they kind of look at you funny if you ask for it straight without the flavorings.
That's definitely, you know, I think because Berlin's bigger, you'll get funny looks, but they won't actually question your sanity. If you go to Leipzig and order the Goza, which is a style that was totally gone and has come back, and you know, maybe it's probably not exactly like it was. There, they'll say, "Are you sure you don't want some syrup with it?" And even when they bring it to you, then they'll ask you a second time, okay, if you don't like this, if it's too sour, I can bring you the syrup. So they're really, because it's unknown in most of Germany. You know, people have never tasted Goza.
Do you really want the hot wings? They're really hot.
Yeah, exactly.
So if we were to want to brew a Berliner Weiss at home, what are the characteristics? What are the keys that to success of brewing a Berliner Weiss?
Well, it's mostly the fermentation for getting the sour quality, which you can, you know, both Y yeast and White Labs, and I'm sure BSI, you know, there'll be other sources as well, can get you the lactobacillus. The thing is, and Kristen England, who makes an absolutely fabulous Berliner Weiss. I was judging at the Upper Mississippi Mash Out just about the time I started working on this book, and that beer won Best of Show, and I was judging Best of Show. I tasted that beer, and I'm going, okay, this is the recipe for Berliner Weiss I want for the book. And his key is you need the lacto to at a 5-to-1 ratio, because otherwise it's going to get overwhelmed. So to get that sourness, you've got to have a really strong lactose start. Now there are other options to doing that. Some people will p- pitch that first to give it a head start. You could also take the approach that Phil Markowski does at Southampton, and his Berliner Weiss, it won the gold at GABF this year, and I think it's won gold at GABF another time as well. And he basically, you know, it's a beer with about half wheat, low alcohol. He completes the fermentation, and you're going to do that with a neutral German ale yeast. Then he adds the lactose in the kegs and sets them aside in the cellar.
Huh.
And then at that point, you're sort of tasting and seeing when it's ready. And that's a way of obviously keeping the lactose separate.
And you can also do a sour mash, right?
You can do a sour mash, and that's another option. That was the approach this last summer. As you may know, Boulevard Brewing in Kansas City now has a separate line of beers called Smokestack. And there are four regular beers in there and then four rotating beers. And they did a rotating beer, which is actually in the style of a wit beer, but that started with a sour mash. And again, you know, that Stephen Powell's, who's the brewmaster there, his thinking, there were two parts to that. He actually found, he's from Belgium, and he found evidence of brewers using that approach at the end of the 19th century for wit beers. And so he took that idea, but also that way you don't have to to bring bugs into your brewery.
Right.
Which is an obvious concern.
Yeah.
For everybody.
We've talked to Stephen on this show, and luckily we get those Smokestack beers down here. And it's fun to see him play with the new brewery, or play with the old brewery, I guess.
Well, they'll do the, it's brewed, but then they come over to the tank. So I happen to have that beer. It wasn't ready at the time, and tasting it out of the tank, you can go, this is really nice. It added a very nice tart quality.
Now, we have Michael Tonsmeyer, the mad fermentationist, sent us a Berliner Weiss that he made, which was no boil.
Right. Well, that's that is, if you want to, first of all, the idea of doing these historically, well, you can pick any time. There were many breweries in Germany doing things different ways. So in 1840, they were doing it one way. In 1870, which is one thing I always like to point out to people who want to have an exact way to do a Berliner Weiss and say, you've got a lot of options. You can pick one and figure out what works for you. And part of it is for any brewer is what works in their environment. You know, if you're where I live here in the Southwest and it'll be getting warm pretty soon, then the idea of leaving stuff, cellaring it, unless you have a temperature controlled chest freezer, is there are certain beers you can or cannot make. If you're up someplace where it's really cold most of the year, and particularly if you're in the winter trying to brew a Belgian triple, then you're going to have a problem getting to the higher finishing temperature.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of your environment to say, oh, what's going to work? I can do this. How do I feel about not doing the boil? But yeah, those beers have no hop quality.
Mm.
You know, the BUs can be down around 2 to 4. They added the hops in the mash. So you would add the hops in the mash and not boil. And by not boiling, obviously, you are creating you're creating the opportunity for a wild fermentation.
And I guess part of that is you want to drink these beers when they're fresh. You don't want them to sit around for a long time because they are kind of unstable.
The Berliner Weiss, you know, it's funny because those used to be put in jars and then stuck on the ground and let age to the right point. So, you know, it comes down to the temperature control. And I'm not, you would want to have more expert person on lacto than me, but you pump up the temperature and it really rips. So you can get there really fast with but otherwise you're controlling the temperature, then you are getting somewhat of a controlled fermentation. What the beers that were drunk incredibly quickly were in the second half of the 19th century, the white beers in Belgium. You know, you see references that beers, people were drinking beer when they were actually still fermenting. Mm. You know, they were like 4 days old.
Yeah, let's talk about the Belgian wit. If you're ready to move on to there.
Oh, that'd be fine.
What we drink today is mostly the construction of one man, right?
Well, and then the variations that came off of that. But the white style was probably made just a little bit by a few breweries, but it was essentially dead, and it was dead in the town of Hoegaarden. And Pierre Celis, I think everybody knows Celis, although as we get a little bit farther away from being able to, you know, where his beers were made in Texas, he's not as prominent. But he was a milkman and sitting around in the local tavern with other locals saying, gee, it's too bad this white beer is gone. We really like this white beer. And so he set out to revive it. He was not a brewer. He's obviously has had the key thing that any brewer has is he could taste the beers and say it needs more of this, it needs more of that. This tastes just right. And he was fortunate enough to work with people who knew what they were doing, find the equipment, supposedly had the old recipe, maybe not. And he revived the Hoegaarden style of white. But that was only one of three prominent styles brewed in that area around Leuven. When us Americans, I think we Americans, think about history, we tend to think first on our own terms, and then also we don't go very far back. So you talk about Belgium, you automatically think about Belgium. Well, Belgium's a relatively young, it's a much younger country than the United States. Before that was the lowlands, and it was associated with the Netherlands, which is sort of an important thing to remember. And when you look at maps, you think about Belgium, Germany, Poland, all different. Well, there was a time when those were much more connected, and northern Germany was different than southern Germany. So if you look and draw a map, so if you go to the Seine Valley, which is where we know lambics are made, and then draw a line clear across that goes between Berlin and Leipzig in Germany and over to Rodzicki, I can't pronounce that, but anyway, in Poland, and did an oval around that line, then you would have the lambic beers in there, the Belgian white beers in there, the Berliner Weiss in there, and the Goza in there, which we really haven't talked about Goza yet, but it's another sour beer with wheat and probably originally with spontaneous fermentation. Those beers are very similar, and they have nothing to do with the wheat beers of southern Germany, which are the Hefeweizen, which in fact originated in Bohemia, which is now, of course, the Czech Republic, just across the border from Germany and northern Bavaria. So when you're thinking about what's related and how beers were made, if you look at it on a geographic basis, then it's a little easier to understand why those beers are alike.
So the Belgian wit that we know today, that kind of branched off of what Celis did, is basically a white beer, maybe slightly tart because of the yeast.
Yeah, well, he would add a little lacto, and some brewers do that.
But then the coriander and the bitter orange peel. I mean, that's basically the description.
Yes, that's basically it's a beer with some pale malt, unmalted wheat, which adds can add some tartness, certainly adds mouthfeel, and adds cloudiness, which is why it's a light beer.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if in backing up into a little bit more of geeky detail, this when people wanted to malt wheat or malt anything in the even the 18th century, then you were going to get dark malt. You know, it was part of the smoking process. But there was some malt that was known as wind malt, and it was put on the roofs of houses and allowed to dry that way so it would remain pale.
Hmm.
So there would be a certain amount of, and then it was known as, it was called, the Germans would call it Weiss, just meaning white, not wheat, which is Weizen. So there's some confusion when you look back over time, realizing all that meant is that was malt dried by wind, so it would remain very pale. But sometimes it was barley malt.
So sometimes the translators might have made a mistake there. And
right. And so if you're not reading it, it gets a little confusing when people were using wheat malt. But in the case of these beers in what's now Belgium, and the particularly the area around Leuven, this was definitely, you had some malt that was dried by wind, so it was white, and then you had some unmalted wheat in there as well. Then you had, and part of it was because of the Belgian laws, the tax laws, and you were taxed on the size of your mash tun. And this is explained very nicely in Phil Markowski's book. If you look at the history of Saison, which is written by Yvan de Bot, who did the foreword to Brewing with Wheat, and also and provided all the information for the historic chapter. There were beers that, if you look at them, that the mashing process includes 21 steps, and you're going along the way exactly, you know, and it's not clear exactly because they are putting more hot water in, but it does seem like that you are creating a great opportunity for some spontaneous fermentation. You know, it's just, it goes on so long and you've got so much the unmalted wheat involved and things like that, that almost, it guaranteed a spontaneous fermentation, which has added a tartness or a sourness to those beers.
So if we're going to make a Belgian wit of the Celles vein, what are the keys to that? I mean, first of all, how do you keep your beer or get your beer cloudy, and how do you keep it cloudy?
Well, the wheat malted or unmalted it has more proteins in it, so it is naturally cloudy. From the standpoint of but no matter how cloudy you make a beer, eventually it will drop clear. Mm-hmm. So you don't want to cellar your white beers. But you're going to get some natural cloudiness. Traditionally, you're going to use 50% wheat. For a variety of reasons, because brewing scientists study everything, there are many reports from Europe where they're saying, okay, what is the best percentage of wheat for a certain amount of haze stability? And it's much less than 50%. It's more like 20%. But over time, 50%'s worked. So there's not any reason to change that. But you could lower that. So you're going to get that haze naturally. You're going to get more of it with protein rest. So a rest around 122 is going to bring out the haziness. You can also, which is much easier for a home brewer to work with, is you want the pre-gelatinized wheat, which, in other words, like torrefied wheat.
Hmm.
That's going to help give you the haziness as well.
It,
and then to sustain the haziness is obviously Your haziness is going to come from a combination of the yeast and the proteins in suspension. If you get too much, and this is why I'll back up a second. So the studies of if you have more protein in your beer, and particularly if the protein is, you don't think of it that way, but the proteins are bigger, if they get heavy enough, they're obviously going to drag everything down, and they're going to bring the yeast down with them. And that's why you're going to get a clearer beer. And that's why it clears naturally over time. If you're kegging your beer, for instance, if you're a home brewer kegging these beers, you could do the same thing that wheat beer producers do in both Belgium and the south of Germany, is when they ship their kegs, they ship them upside down. So when they get to the bar, they turn them right side up, and that's going to kick everything back.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's counterintuitive. You think more wheat means more cloudy, but not necessarily. But
right.
you can also, you don't have to use all the same kind of wheat. You can use malted wheat and raw wheat and some torrified wheat.
Exactly. The only thing, you know, with the raw wheat, then your conversion's going to take a little bit longer. But there's actually a friend of mine who provided the Hefeweizen recipe for the book makes a wonderful wit beer. And one of the things he loves about doing is the idea, you know, you can go to the health food store and buy the wheat there. You know, it's kind of a cooler way to get your grains.
You can feel better about yourself, maybe.
Yeah.
But you need to support your local homebrew store, too.
Well.
let's move it. You mentioned Weiss beers. And you go into a lot of detail. I mean, one of the things that I like about the book is that you go from brewery to brewery and you talk about their process in a level of detail where if you're a home brewer and you kind of know what you're doing, you can get an idea of how you can apply those processes into your brewery. Because there's more than one way to skin a cat on these things. And so it's interesting to see how different breweries take different approaches to get similar results. So we're not delving into, you know, the greatest amount of detail here, but you know, along with some recipes for these, you go into the parameters of each of these beers and the processes that it kind of, just like in Brew Like a Monk, some light bulbs are going off in my head of, you know, some things that I can try in my home brewery as well. So that's just a little plug there.
I'm not somebody to tell you this is the one way to brew a perfect Hefeweizen. I'd rather tell you how other people approach it. And this is something I learned in doing Brew Like a Monk, which is, before that I hadn't really written about stuff geared specifically for brewers, home brewers or otherwise, is the brewers within the Trappist monasteries, who you thought would be the most secretive in the world, and they won't tell you everything about ingredients, or at least they'll tell you almost everything about ingredients, but not percentages. But man, they tell you everything about process.
Huh.
You know, people are almost totally open about process. And I was a little surprised. Once in a while, I would bump into people in doing brewing with wheat when they weren't anymore. I just expect people to tell me, and I ask them the questions and they just keep answering it. And at the beginning I was surprised, but now I sort of expect that. And they don't always, particularly at larger breweries, you're going to find out less about process, but from a home brewer standpoint or a smaller brewer standpoint, that's not real important because you weren't going to be able to do what they do anyway.
We could try.
Yeah, well, but you don't want to. You know, you don't, you know, Schneider that produces, Schneider and Son that sort of, that revived the wheat beer style in the south of Germany and make Schneider Weiss and Aventinus. They make 300,000 hectoliters a year. That's pretty big. You know, that's so that's about 250,000 barrels a year. And they make their beer very traditionally. You know, there's lots to be learned from them.
So let's talk about the Hefeweizens. I mean, what are we talking about now? What character are we looking at for that style?
Well, there's a lot of personal preference in those because for many people, Weinstephan Hefeweizen defines the style, and that's got a pretty sizable amount of banana character to it, and it's not nearly as clovey. You go further north into Germany, if you go out and buy Weinstephan and go out and buy Schneiderweiss side by side, you're going to taste the Schneiderweiss and you're going to go, this has more clove character. Sometimes there were beers I had more in the countryside. There are about 600 Weizen beer breweries in Bavaria. You know, everybody makes it. And I had beers that had more clove character than Schneiderweiss. But I really like the balance of Schneiderweiss. But you taste that one, and you taste the Weinstephan, and you're going, oh, these. You begin to see the difference and some character you may or may not want to have come out in the beer. My brother, for instance, considers that bitter. Mm. You know, the clovey character comes across to him as bitter.
So when we're talking about banana and clove, unlike the Belgian wit, there's no fruit or spice in there.
Oh, no, that would be against the Reinheitsgebot, which does allow for wheat beers. It's totally a fermentation character and an intentional fermentation character. If you think about the Belgian strong yeast, the Belgian wheat yeast, and the Southern German wheat yeast, those are all the brewing chemists refer to those as phenolic off flavor yeast, which tells you what they're thinking right there, because that's the word off flavor. Mm-hmm. You know, that's not a character that they can control or that they want in the beer. In the case of the Hefeweizen, that yeast is the one that reacts with ferulic acid, which comes from the malt, which can come from barley malt or wheat malt, and creates a phenol, which is 4-glycol, 4-vinyl glycol, which we'll just refer to as 4-VG from this moment on. And that creates the clove character. And so that's a phenol from the fermentation. The banana is the exact same ester that you get in Belgian strong beers like West Mall or the yeast that really does it is Chimay yeast. You think of a Chimay yeast gives you all that banana character, which is isoamyl. So you're looking for a balance between that particular phenol and the ester, and then you can make your own decision. Do I want more clove, less clove? Do I want more ester, less ester?
So what are the knobs in the process that we can twist to control those?
Well, if you can do a step infusion, then you're looking to do it, and I'll do the quick conversion. But generally, almost all the research is done on the continent, so they're going to tell you it's between 43 and 45 Celsius, which is about 111 to 115 Fahrenheit. So a rest there will promote the production of ferulic acid. That'll help bring it out of the malt. As I said, barley malt has a fair amount of ferulic acid too, but it sits in a different part of the barley, and it's a little bit harder to extract. And to back up for a moment, some of the first research anybody was paying attention to about production of ferulic acid was actually done by Guinness. And that's because it was their goal to keep it out of the beer. Mm. So, and those were all barley beers. So barley will produce ferulic acid, but wheat is better at it. Additionally, it's going to happen at a higher pH. The best extraction is like at about the pH of about 5.7. So you might do that step with a little higher pH, and then you want to make sure you're lowering your pH. In the German breweries, they are adding they're using either acidulated malt or adding some lacto, which they're actually creating themselves by taking it off the malt, and they're adding the lacto in the boiling kettle to bring down the pH in the boiling kettle. So you're going to get more with a longer rest at 115. Schneider's rest is 10 minutes, and you're going to get more with a little bit higher pH, and you're also going to get more by keeping the ratio of water to grain in your grist a little bit higher. Those will all boost the extraction, and that'll give you more ferulic acid. But it's not just a matter of getting more ferulic acid. You've got to get a yeast that's going to produce more 4VG during the fermentation process. And some people are, and I have no reason not to believe this, feel that you're going to get that yeast, that the breweries in the north of Bavaria, that yeast just naturally produces more clove character. So that's a way to get more clove. To get the higher ester production is letting your temperatures go a little bit higher, but you're not going anywhere near where the Belgians go.
So what range are we talking about?
You're still going to be like in the low 70s.
Low 70s, which would be around the lower 20s?
No, I mean it's 70s in Fahrenheit.
Right, sorry. Right.
What's it, 20, like 20 or 22?
Yeah, somewhere around
Celsius.
There.
Just to give you things you can diddle around with, because all of these are factors. You know, it's how much you aerate your wort going in. Because we're talking about yeast growth when we get to the ester part. And then what these yeasts can be very unforgiving. Open fermentation naturally leaves them more forgiving. At a homebrew level, you're going, well, I'm not going to leave my beer sitting out. But you could, if you ferment in plastic buckets, don't fill them up all the way so you get a ratio of more like 1-to-1 instead of whatever the bucket would be like, where your height is 3-to-1 over your width or 2.5. So you're going to lower that and just leave the lid open a little bit. That's going to be more like open fermentation, and that's going to ease that. But these are all things from every time you produce the beer, you know, change one thing and see, okay, is this working? Is this working? Am I getting closer to where I want? So then eventually you can dial in what you want, and it's going to work with your own environment with whatever yeast you can get handily.
So should you skim during fermentation?
Yes. You go into Schneider, which is just walk into their fermentation room with all these giant open fermenters. Just, you know, I love open fermenters, so it's a porn thing for me. they're just gorgeous. And you see the guys are skimming the top of that, and you're going, so how many generations do you use your yeast? Well, they don't. They start again with every one. Most of the time in Germany, they'll reuse their yeast 2, 3, 4 times. But they're starting anew for a variety of reasons. But they're still skimming every time because you're taking a little bit of tube off the top, a little bit of hops is coming up because you don't want any, we haven't talked about hops, but you shouldn't taste any hops in these beers. They're going to be, you know, 12 to 14 BUs. So you would be skimming because it's going to give you a smoother beer.
So let's move on to the United States.
Okay.
Unfortunately, I gave us the least amount of time. But in a way, Americans are brewing these styles or takes on these styles. And it wasn't, Prohibition killed wheat beer brewing in the United States, and it didn't come back until the 1980s.
Right.
That's just incredible.
In that case, and Anchor was the first to do it, and they did it just to put out what was basically First of all, Anchor was investigating, I don't know if that's right, was experimenting with a lot of old world beers. You know, they brought back porter and barley wine and IPA and so on. So, but in the case of the wheat beer, that was just brewed with a neutral ale yeast. And about that same time, that's when you started to have a proliferation of brew pubs in the country in the 1980s. Wynkoop, for instance, was like the 100th brewery to open in the country. So there weren't that many breweries, but brew pubs were starting to open. And looking for, they could make a light beer, and they couldn't make a lager because their brewing setups were not appropriate for lager. And so wheat beer became kind of their, you like Bud Light, try this beer. You know, it's nice and neutral. It's not too much alcohol. In all fairness, there were a lot of really boring beers. Mm. It was also a beer that, the brewers didn't want to, they viewed most fruit beers as gimmicks. But you could brew this base wheat beer, and then you could add the fruit to that, so you could have two or three beers out of it, to serve out of one beer. Two to three beers that a lot of brewers didn't want to make it, so they got to brew once, add stuff to it, and go back to doing what they want to do.
So even with a well-made wheat beer, with the cloudiness of the product, you've got a kind of a barrier or a hurdle that you've got to jump over, at least initially with consumer education.
Yeah, but you know, it's funny because obviously that turned things around for Widmer, and then it turned things around for Boulevard in the Midwest. But Boulevard did almost drop its unfiltered wheat because people were going, I've got this cloudy beer, what's wrong with it? And they had to go back and educate the consumer and start at a smaller level or as a showpiece, which happened, even though nobody talked to each other, it happened in much the same way in Portland, Oregon, as it did in the Kansas City area, where you would have a bar getting behind the beer, serving the cloudy beer, making a display of it. And now people are looking at the cloudy beer. And if you're somebody who, and we hate this idea, I know that beer would be a badge. But if you wanted to show off that you were drinking something different, that cloudy beer tells people that right off.
And the most important question, probably, I've saved, you know, near the end of the interview, with fruit or without? Do you get a slice of, is it heresy to put a slice of orange on the glass or not?
That's going to depend upon the brewer, but that's one of the things that caused Blue Moon White to take off, was the decision to add that orange on the side. And you do it in the south of Germany, and you're telling people you're a tourist.
To me, it's like taking a nicely prepared rack of dry-rubbed ribs, smoked all day, and then slathering KC Masterpiece barbecue sauce on it. That's just me.
Right. But people do that, and people like it, and I'm not... You know, Blue Moon White began in the brew pub within the Rockies ballpark, and they still brew Blue Moon White in there, but they sell a lot of it at the ball games. So the rest of the ballpark, if you buy the Blue Moon White, you're going to get beer that's now that's made in Eden, North Carolina. So I wanted to try, this was about 3 years ago, I wanted to try the Blue Moon White as it's made at the stadium. So we've got to, you know, we're sitting out in the bleachers, and we got to come in and we order the beer, and my wife says, I'll buy this round. And I'm not going to say no. So then she looks and she doesn't have the money. So we're talking about this real quick. And in that moment, the guy put the orange in my Blue Moon White. And I was ticked. I immediately took the orange out and dropped it on the bar. I'm seeing he's not too pleased with me either. I'm going, I want to taste this beer. You know, and as soon as you put the orange in, I'm not going to taste the same thing. However, it's intended to be served with the orange. If a brewer is making a beer that that orange as a garnish is part of the flavor, then that becomes part of the beer, and I think you got to respect that.
Well, there you go. I'll wrap up with one story. I was in a Mexican restaurant one time, and I ordered a Bass Ale, and the waitress brought it to me without a glass, of course, and a wedge of lime sticking on the top. So think about that.
Well, maybe it was really old Bass, and they knew that.
I think they were confused as to why the Corona bottle was brown. I don't know.
Yeah.
Well, Stan, we've just scratched the surface, you know, as usual. I want to urge home brewers who want to learn more about wheat beers and to be able to make some decisions about how to make good wheat beers, to pick up the book and read it for themselves. It's interesting from a history standpoint, and also interesting from a technical standpoint as well.
And you could also urge them to come see both of us in the National Homebrew Conference
in
Minneapolis in June, and we'll answer more of these questions.
Oh, there you go. Yeah, come
have, and I hope have some interesting experiments, including brewing with wheat and wheat yeast.
Yeah, lots of good stuff up there. Well, thanks, Stan.
My pleasure.
Well, thanks again to Stan. Brewing with Wheat was a fun read. And we just, like I said in the interview, we just barely scratched the surface. So grab you a copy. And I predict that this will be the summer of brewing wheat beers here at the house. It sparked my imagination quite a bit. Just like Brew Like a Monk did with the Belgian styles. If you have brewing questions, show suggestions, or just want to say howdy, write to james@basicbrewing.com or just fill out the contact form on basicbrewing.com, and please don't forget to tell us where you're from. Our 2010 Brewers Logbooks, still going out the door, as are our Reinheitsgebot is a four-letter word shirts as well. Check out our homebrewing DVDs, Introduction to Extract Homebrewing, Stepping into All Grain, Low-Tech Lagering and Decoction Mashing, and Introduction to Wine Kits. And we've got combo deals on our site to save you a couple of bucks. And you can see a listing of the fine folks across the country who sell our DVDs on basicbrewing.com. And if there isn't a vendor in your area, you can order them online in our online shop at basicbrewingshop.com. And thanks to everybody who's continued to click on our Amazon.com link. We appreciate the support there. Our featured products this week that were purchased through the link are Nyko Solar-Powered Auto Darkening Welding Helmet, ANSI approved, and Hanna Instruments HI190M1 Magnetic Stirrer. Thanks again, everybody. Remember, I can't tell who bought what, so no worries there. Just click on the Amazon.com logo on our site the next time you feel like Amazon shopping, and we appreciate your support. You can also join the American Homebrewers Association and subscribe to Brew Your Own magazine through our associate links, too. That's all until next week. Until then, thanks for listening. I'm James Spencer, production help for Basic Brewing Radio, and our website is provided by our buddy Kelly Dotson down in Austin, Texas. Basic Brewing Radio is a production of Active Voicing. We'll talk to you next time, everybody. So long.